coming up next. It's hour number one of the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to a beautiful cloudy day today in Santa Cruz. No wind. Perfect for flying drones.
It was a great compliment to the full moon last night, those clouds. I loved it.
Yeah, wasn't it beautiful? It was really nice.
Gorgeous.
That's Mrs. Future you're speaking with myself, Dr. Future, a.k.a. Al Lundell, and my real-time wife.
Son Lundell.
Yeah. Yeah, so I like the Harley Carnes story on how we need drone fields to practice in.
Yeah, we were just out practicing with your drone this weekend.
Yeah, yesterday you were out there and we flew it for the first time, the Typhoon G, and it flew like a champ, at least in the year. But here's a suggestion, folks. If you're going to buy a drone, definitely practice a lot, because I was feeling pretty good after being in the field and being able to control the drone going up and down and left and right and turning the camera up and down, all those fun things. And then I had to show it off at some friend's house, and my friends don't have a field. They have redwood trees
and a driveway
and not grass. And mm-hmm. I made one mistake and it flew into a tree and broke three blades immediately. Ooh, I know, right?
Torture.
So, we need a nice playground.
You have to replace those blades. At least they're kind of made. They're the flimsiest part of the drone.
I think that's the perfect use for 3D printers, is to print out spare blades as you break them on your drone, which you will do.
Yeah, just melt down the old ones and run them through the pattern again and print them out.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, Drone Tales, folks, if you have any thoughts on drones you want to share, we're one of
our favorite passionate topics here.
Yes.
I do have a number of really interesting stories, and one I just saw you reviewing just before we came on the air that I thought I hadn't looked at for a while.
Hey, let's tell people where they can look at them if they happen to be online.
DrFutureShow.com/links. We'll take you to the links page.
That's right. And you can read for yourself the articles that we're talking about.
Now, what I remember about the article was that it was the MIT crew has figured out how to genetically modify viruses to create better energy transport, i.e., like better ways of moving energy through the human body. Now, that's interesting, right? That's, that's playing with the power of sugar. Is there a better way of getting energy to the body than sugar and caffeine?
Well, I think that is how the energy goes to the body, through sugar and caffeine channels.
But what's interesting here is that they're not just using chemicals, they're using GMO viruses. Right, GMO, genetically modified viruses to create more energy, transporting through the humans.
Yeah, this is actually not as scary as it sounds.
No, that's my cautionary mind in action. I see the implications of more energy.
Yes, and what they're doing actually is taking nature and studying it and then basically increasing its efficiency, I would say.
Better transport.
Yes, the transport mechanism for the energy is being enhanced through engineering, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And doesn't that equal more energy?
It equals more energy, yes.
Okay.
Are you going to give people the details, or are you going to make them go to the website?
I'm going to make them go to the website, unless you want to share them.
No,
because there's so many other stories to do. But basically, the takeaway is energy virus is being genetically modified, created at MIT. You want to know more, go to our links page. It's a very interesting article. It even has an animation of the process, which is way cool.
Yes, and of course, Dr. Future, being the author of Virus.
That's true.
Computer Viruses, and what was the subtitle?
I'm not proud of the subtitle. The PR ad agency people came up with it.
Yeah.
Computer Invaders That Breed and Destroy. Computer invaders that breed and destroy.
Yes, and so in his days as a tech journalist, Dr. Future did some research on viruses, and of course that...
And the invention of viruses.
Yes.
Yeah, and how they... So here
it's
we're using...
It's a classic in the field.
That's true. I mean, it is interesting that humanity has mimicked nature in creating viruses, and we've infected our machines with them.
Well, we understand how efficient nature is, and we just try and emulate it.
As often as possible.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff we learn from nature. Some of the other stories this week, we're trying to study also the knowledge of ancient man. There's a very interesting piece of scientists who are getting inside four Egyptian pyramids, but without digging.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's novel.
Isn't it?
Sure.
Of How do you see what's inside an Egyptian pyramid?
Tunnels, you know, you can just walk inside.
You could. And I suspect they'll probably use those tunnels to penetrate the walls near the tunnels. Mm-hmm. In this case, there is a major focus on four pyramids in Egypt, where they're working with the technologies of infrared thermography, 3D scanners with lasers and drones, and cosmic ray detectors. Mm. And I would also add ground-penetrating radar. You know, that's a staple in the exploration of shapes and objects and spaces, underground spaces especially.
And so do you like this because it makes places that used to be invisible visible?
Yeah. Yeah, I like seeing the invisible visible, don't you?
Sure.
I mean, that's where a lot of stuff, 9.9% of the universe is invisible to the human perception. So yeah, our tools start to open it up a little bit, and still maybe we're only getting another couple percentage awareness of what's going on in the universe. Yeah, I like those tools.
So infrared thermography, huh?
Yeah.
It extends our visual range into a whole new set of frequencies.
That's right. And you can see stuff behind the walls with this. So that's an interesting article. Definitely, if you're interested in that kind of technology, like I think the cosmic ray technique that scans nuclear particles that are in the chamber already, I think that's fascinating. They've used those techniques at Fukushima for looking at what's going inside because they don't want to go in there.
Sure. Right. And so they just did a little infrared scan, huh?
No, it was a cosmic ray scan.
Cosmic
ray. That's a whole other deal.
Oh, so this is yet cosmic another way of looking into the places where we can't see. Okay, so the cosmic rays are like little radiation detectors?
Cosmic ray signatures is what they're looking for in there. They're looking inside the chambers of the pyramids for cosmic ray signatures. In this particular article, they don't go deeply into the tech, but they have links if you want to go more into understanding cosmic ray scanning of spaces. That's definitely gets into more like one of the MIT articles.
Cool. You're listening to the Dr. Future Show, and we'll be back in just a few, so stay tuned.
Here's another little disruptive piece of technology coming along.
Oh, that's your very favorite.
Disruptive? No, that's Silicon Valley's favorite term. I just like to use it. Very handy.
Oh, it doesn't have to be disruptive technology for you to like it.
Well, what's disruptive in one context is completely productive in another.
Absolutely. Yes. In fact, this is transcendent. This technology goes through barriers.
Let me give you an example. We've heard of a lot about the flying robots and drones from me. And you,
yes.
Right? Yeah, especially me.
So, naturally,
I found a very interesting piece in the BBC about how there is a group at Harvard that created a flying bee, a robot bee. Okay. And then they figured out how to make it swim. They copied a puffin. So, this is a form of puffin biomimicry. Mm-hmm. Puffin biomimicry.
And of course, a puffin is a bird.
Yes, it's a bird that can fly and it can swim really well.
Right.
So now we've created a device. I hate to call them drones anymore because that's kind of a limited term that goes from flying, from being an insect basically, to becoming a swimming bird.
A swimming bird. And of course, what makes it a drone is that it's a remote control swimming or flying device.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. At some point, it'll have autonomous intelligence as well. So here you go. How do you regulate such technologies, especially if they're really cheap? They're no longer drones because they're not about flying. They're about swimming. And they're about submarine. What do you have? Underwater rules that you suddenly apply? You apply both maritime and FAA rules for aviation simultaneously to these creatures. These poor guys. Every regulation agency in the universe is going to want them once they fully explore their capabilities. The robotic bee is copying puffins to fly and swim. The good news is that it leads us to better research tools for exploring the universe. because suddenly we can keep our eyes and ears open as we fly and swim, like following something in nature, for example. There are maybe puffin cams. If we wanted to really understand how these creatures called puffins can both fly and swim, we could have our drone follow them really closely, maybe pretend to be one, join the puffin families, and learn from them from their point of view. So from an exploratory point of view, it gets really interesting.
Yes. Well, I don't think that the imitation of the puffin is going to look like a puffin to a puffin.
No, you're right. I was reflecting, but it could though.
No,
you could make a really cute looking robot that's really sexy to a puffin. And it's ridiculous, I know, but still you could.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think most animals can tell that the fake things are not what they are pretending to
be. But what if we could get one of our robots to be fully accepted as a mate of a puffin? Wouldn't we learn so much about them at that point as a species?
I know. Biomimicry is...
I know. It puts us in their eye. Eisenstein showed that we could do this. We could cut videos so that we can look in each other's points of view in a movie where we
can understand why
here
it's
we
very
can take the point of view of a puffin.
To try and think like an animal and understand the world the way an animal understands
it. I think it would give us
world.
A deeper understanding of nature just to put ourselves in their shoes.
Absolutely.
Just for a few minutes.
I agree.
That's an example of how that will become possible, the puffin robotics. They'll go to other species, of course, and you'll be able to choose whatever species you would like to experience.
Well, very interesting. These little insects are miracles of engineering, which we are nowhere near equaling.
I know. That's the thing, is that that's why we need to study them and have our little robots follow them.
Absolutely. Learn with respect.
Yeah. We do have to learn to tune into what are the appropriate boundaries in communicating with these other species. Many people in our audience have been to the hospital and have dealt with doctors a lot and stuff like that. I mean, who hasn't these days? And many perhaps have had to deal with having pacemakers installed. Well, there's a very interesting breakthrough in that world where researchers have learned how to steer the heart with light.
Oh, lighthearted. Sounds like a real breakthrough.
It is. We depend on electrical waves to regulate the rhythm of our heartbeat. When those signals go awry, the result is potentially fatal arrhythmia.
Yeah, the heart has to beat in rhythm. When it loses its pulse,
where
everything gets screwed up.
We go to a zero state really fast. So now a team of researchers from Oxford and Stony Brook universities have found a way to precisely control those waves using light.
Mm-hmm.
You get the ability to steer the type of waves that you have.
Okay, so basically these little connectors, these channel rhodopsin devices, are being used to affect the electromagnetism of the blood so that its pulsing is not screwed up, so that you don't get those kind of clogged, arrhythmic discrepancies.
And the fact that it is better than the existing systems that basically don't have a feedback loop. So it's a quantum leap forward in our ability to really help the heart when it's having arrhythmia and having problems like this.
And according to this article, what's going on in the heart as the blood is coursing through, you know, there's an electromagnetic current that is being generated. Mm-hmm. And that current is screwed up if there's a blockage that forces the blood to go in places where it's not
like a scarring
expected.
Tissue, like scarring tissue, for example.
Yeah, and then that starts creating disruptive electromagnetic frequencies that
bounce
back
through the fluid.
Yeah, and then that causes heartbeats that are not in phase with everything else.
Yeah.
So what this is doing is creating a way of mitigating those blockages through using a light channel. It's a protein that's sensitive to light, right?
Optogenetics makes proteins sensitive to light.
And
yes.
Then they're putting those light-sensitive proteins into the area, and then they're using light to activate those proteins so that they can stabilize those erratic beats.
Help the system get the beat back.
Right. Yeah.
Those clever monkeys.
Really?
Let's get back into the beat. Come on. Very good.
Yeah, well, another case of seeing into places where we couldn't see before. In this case, it's with some channel rhodopsin devices.
Yeah. Here's the way they explain it. A protein called channel rhodopsin is delivered to heart cells using gene therapy techniques so that they could be controlled by light. Then using a computer-controlled light projector, the team was able to control the speed of the cardiac waves, their direction, and even the orientation of spirals in real time, something that's never been shown for waves in a living system before.
It's amazing.
Yeah, so the ability to provide fine control means that the researchers are able to carry out experiments on a level of detail that have never before possible, except maybe in computer models.
And what a great way to do a light show. A light show that can prevent a heart attack and can bring light to your heart.
Yeah, as it gets smarter, if you're known to have different heart conditions, it would be programmed for precisely looking for those heart conditions.
Right.
And expect the little tricks of strangeness that will happen to your heartbeat.
Boy.
Precise control and direction. You know, so that's the direction we're heading with this. Pretty cool, huh?
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I'm for anything that'll put more light in people's hearts. Definitely.
There is evidence to suggest that the universe, as we know it, is still very young yet. So we're one of the first Earths, the first generation of Earths.
Mm-hmm.
There's a long time that we have in the universe. So in the Star Wars lore, we would be the early Jedi times. Right, not the later ones that are supposedly now.
We're like the cavemen of the Jedi generation.
The universe is like 7% of its life already. You know, we're so very early in this universe.
Oh, you're calling our universe a seven-year-old?
Yeah.
In universe years.
In terms
years.
Of theoretical model from NASA.
Okay.
I have an interesting link to that if you're curious how they figured they came to that conclusion.
Okay, so let's see. What does this link say? It says that if we want to predict how many Earth-like planets there are in our universe, based on what we know, we can tell that only 7% of the potential has been utilized.
I think
utilized
that's the number.
So
I don't swear by it. It's something low like that. But basically, Earth came early to the party.
Right.
In this evolving universe.
That's good news. All right, folks. So see, that's good incentive to keep it alive. All right.
Yeah.
Gotta go. We'll be back after CBS News. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. There are some new foam batteries that promise fast charging and high capacity.
Foam
my dear.
Batteries.
Foam, yeah.
Whatever will we do with our foam batteries?
Well, affordable, they're lightweight, they're versatile, the porous stuff, you know, porous materials, spongy things.
Spongy batteries,
Batteries seem to like spongy things.
They do.
They do.
Tell us about these spongy batteries. What do you like about them?
They're going to give us a more versatile form of power. You want to know the real story behind it?
Yeah.
I think it's a high form of biomimicry. I think it's leading to us creating an energy source that's compatible with biology directly.
Very
not nice. Just with 110 or 240 volt AC, none of that.
I think nature has already invented foam batteries and we're just catching up.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think not in the context. See, what's interesting about our species is that we can take knowledge from all the other realms that we're exploring and mix and combine them in creative, interesting ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a special gift that we have of being very creative species, like tools, for example. You know, other species maybe have created them, but we've done the most with them. So that is our big contribution to nature, is tool making.
Mm-hmm.
I see us as part of a bigger movie. The species is part of 17 million species, which is part of one ecosystem.
And of course,
on this
if we're
planet.
Going to take advantage of tools, we'll need to have batteries so that we can take them with us.
Right. And what has nature done with batteries? Well, she's created mitochondria.
Oh, the batteries of the cell.
And I think mitochondrial batteries are probably the clue to the direction. So a spongy, it kind of gets my attention.
Uh-huh.
I think it's in the right direction.
Right. Yeah, I think of the mitochondria as the hearth of the cell.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the lady's domain where the cell does everything to keep things warm in there, right? That's the mitochondria's job, to generate heat.
Generates heat. That's right. It's the hearth.
Yeah. What about these spongy batteries? Like, what are we going to do with them?
Same thing. Keep us warm. Keep our electronic hearths warm.
It seems like what they're doing with these spongy batteries is they're just replacing parts of existing batteries. They're just going to take the connector and make it spongy instead
of
solid.
Take away solid metal, platinum, and put sponge in its place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So it's just a piece to the puzzle.
I guess that's useful for clothing.
Spongy clothes?
Well, no, the connector. You know, you need to have things that are flexible, right?
That's true. And connectors are a big problem in putting technology in clothing because they break all the time. And clothing needs to be very break-proof, shall we say. And if it's in the cloth itself, then it's less likely to break.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So sponginess in the cloth? Yeah, we use sponges in clothes, right? Don't women use sponges and like shoulder pads?
Sure. Yeah, sponges help you keep the perfect balance between flexibility and form.
Yeah, yeah. So those could be the power sources for whatever electronic jewelry we're wearing.
Great, our shoulder pads to power our iPhones.
Why not, you know? Two in one.
Great.
Yeah, it's a shoulder pad. Hey, it keeps your phone charged. It's a no-brainer.
Those days are coming.
I'm telling you.
Okay.
Phone batteries. They're a nice direction to move in. I'm going to be watching that.
Okay.
There was a very, very good global article on Bill Gates.
Mm-hmm.
Bill has taken a global perspective on energy, on the whole topic of energy, and has come up with some interesting stats for you to know about.
Okay. All right. I'm all ears. He's calling the private sector inept.
Well, he has his opinions, no doubt about it. But
he should talk.
Well, what he's doing is he's dropping $2 billion of his own money on green energy investments.
Mm-hmm.
$2 billion.
Great.
And he's asking his fellow billionaire buddies to do the same. And what's the goal here? Well, to be fossil free by 2050. Fossil free by 2050.
Wow. Well, the last time I saw Bill making a challenge was part of that ice bucket challenge. He's really up the ante here. Now he wants $2 billion for green tech, huh?
And he thinks that big government R&D is really good and that big government is the best for that. And private sector, not so good at R&D. Because private sector, when you stop and think about it, is concerned more about the bottom line. And it has to reduce the amount of money on R&D because R&D can be a black hole for money.
Absolutely. And yet, if the government's doing it, it's...
Yeah,
I mean,
it's better that the government own the black hole than the private sector. Or the whole private sector could go in it.
Well,
you know,
actually,
black holes are dangerous.
I was going to say that
sometimes.
Anything that the government is doing supposedly should be scrutable. We should be able to have some kind of accountability, right? The big argument for less government spending is that the government doesn't have the incentives of a business to watch the bottom line.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
They've got too much money to throw at the problem.
Yeah, then they have to cut back on the budget and trim it when it gets out of control, which inevitably does.
Nobody's watching it.
Yeah, things grow by themselves. If you're not watching them, they'll grow like weeds.
Yeah, there's an incentive to get more money from the government if nobody's watching how much you're spending.
Yeah, or if you can get your money, then your project continues because everybody's project can continue in a way. It's like a TV series.
Right.
Till it gets old. But who's judging?
Anyway, so Bill Gates wants the government to do more R&D.
Yeah, and he points out that since World War II, U.S. government R&D has defined the state of the art in almost every area.
He's talking about DARPA.
Well, among other things. And he says the private sector, says Gates, is in general inept in such things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the private sector is sort of don't ask, don't tell, and we're going to try and make things as cheaply as possible, but we don't have to be accountable if we're causing harm unless somebody takes us to court.
Right.
Right. Whereas somehow the government is different than that. I don't know.
He says DARPA money, he thought, was very well spent, and the basic science money is very well spent, and that he'd like to see up to four times as much money going into government R&D. So that's part of it. And the other idea is that the precedence has been set by other countries, like Germany, for example. They set a new record this year where 78% of German electricity was from renewable sources. 78%.
That is amazing.
40.65 gigawatts. It's enough to run the time machine. 40.65 gigawatts from wind and solar energy alone.
Wow.
4.85 gigawatts from biomass. That's like cow poop.
Is it?
Well, biomass.
Biomass, yeah. That
would
like
be a form
ethanol?
Of biomass. Yeah, yeah, ethanol, plants.
Uh-huh.
2.4 gigawatts of hydro. So they don't have as much water power in Germany.
Right.
47.9 green gigawatts. And how much do you think they need as a country?
Well, if that's 78%, I guess they need about 50.
61.1.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So, plus, they have been successful reducing their CO2 by 4.3%. China, meanwhile, has put in $80 billion in green energy investment, which is more than the U.S. and Europe combined. So green energy investment, China has put more in than the U.S. and Europe.
So the Chinese government has $80 billion.
Yeah, U.S.
compared
has put
to Bill Gates and his $2
billion. Yeah, well, they're a mega, you know, super.
Well, I just think it's interesting that China and Bill are on the same scale, even, right?
Well, he's on a scale, the $2 billion, you know, where he's giving.
He's
in the game.
The $2 billion
right, he's
club.
In the game. All right, they're talking the big players are $80 billion. He's two. He's a two. But he knows people.
Right. Say, listen, let's say hello to Jeff from Salinas before we go to our next break.
Huh? Sure.
All right. Hello, Jeff from Salinas. How you doing?
Hey, Jeff.
I'm doing okay. The weather's pretty good over here. I just kind of caught your program here. I've been busy for about an hour or an hour and a half. But anyway, yeah. You know, Bill Gates, they could get some of that money instead of us giving it to Planned Parenthood for their... No good that they're doing and abortions and poisoning babies and stuff. That'd be a $500 million right there.
Yeah, well, I love Planned Parenthood. I use Planned Parenthood for things that have nothing to do with abortion. And I think it's so lame to use that argument to defund something that is a staple for women's health. I really do. I really think it's small-minded.
No, it's actually very large-minded. 300,000...
Judgments now.
Yes.
Let's play fair. Yes.
Anyway, we're talking about green tech.
Yeah.
And it's okay to say you don't like Planned Parenthood, but what do you have to say about green tech?
Green... Say that again.
Yeah,
green what?
A tech. Green
yeah,
tech.
Yeah, what we're actually talking about. You know,
yeah, we're
Bill
actually
Gates,
talking about, right.
Like saying that he's going to give $2 billion to do R&D for green technology. And we're looking at the countries of the world like Germany and China that are succeeding in reducing the amount of carbon.
Did you know Germany, for example, 78% of Germany's electricity this year was from renewable resources. 78%. Isn't that amazing?
I'm glad you're talking about this.
Yeah.
If I can pull this out of my backpack, I have something from the newsletter from the Heartland Association, and I was speaking about this very thing at the county supervisors meeting, and I'm going to try to find it. You know, if it's the private money...
Tell you what, Jeff, we're going to go to a break, and then
You'll find that, and we'll bring you back on. We've got a couple other stories we'll be doing simultaneously.
In the meantime,
so take your time searching, okay?
Yes.
Fine, just find it.
We'll be right back.
More programming ahead. Okay, we're back on the Dr. Future Show. We were just talking about Bill Gates, and he was giving us some. Bill was giving us a view of going totally green by 2050, and that it's doable.
All right, Jeff, did you find something in your backpack there?
And that some countries are already doing
it.
78% in Germany alone, and you found something. It triggered off something in Jeff's brain here, and he's about to tell us what that is.
Okay, this is a newsletter.
Yeah.
From the Heartland Institute.
The Heartland Institute, okay.
Yes, and anyone can look online, and they can subscribe, and it's fantastic. They get into different topics.
Okay.
And on page 11, page 10, they have an interview with Sherwood Iso, the President, Center for the Carbon Study of Carbon Dioxide and Global Change.
Yeah.
And the headline is, Carbon Dioxide Feeds the World. And on the other side, the other page, increasing atmospheric carbon dioxide is key to preventing mass starvation. Mm. Now, I just got this.
Okay, well, those are interesting movies. I mean, those are scenarios that people have thought of. That's what they do in Washington, think up scenarios.
Anyway, I don't think any of the three of us are experts on what's going on with carbon trading. And, you know, it's true that plants eat carbon dioxide and breathe out oxygen. So carbon dioxide is not the problem. The problem is pollution. Pollution, putting extra carbon into the air.
No, you put more fertilizer, which carbon dioxide is.
Well, it's not just that. It's the heat, it's the deforestation, it's the lack of plants being able to do their job because we're making their environment too hostile by making it too hot.
No, because more plant growth. When you have colder weather, you have less plant growth or freezing. But when you have a warmer weather and a higher carbon dioxide concentration to a point, then you will get more lush growth.
Yeah, we got to be careful of runaway greenhouse effect. That's the big bad borderline that we don't want to cross. Otherwise, we become like Venus, and that's no fun at all, at least for our species.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, appreciate your call, Jeff.
Good job.
Sorry, we just have a few more minutes left, and we're ready to move on to the article.
Jeff needs to hold the salon somewhere. He's got a lot to tell people.
That's true. I agree. And but if we were doing a show on global warming today, that'd be great. But I know you got a couple more articles.
Yeah. Well, global warming, we definitely have our researchers in the field in that front and really pulling that in, especially mass planetary extinctions. There is another very interesting article this week about how basically asteroids and comets have caused mass planetary extinctions in the past, mostly caused
there
planets and comets.
Uh-huh.
So
it's not just carbon. Actually, you know, the whole thing with the carbon footprint of human activity being an extinction-causing event is really small when you start thinking about the life of the planet and this article about how many things cause extinction-level events that have nothing to do with the human footprint, right?
It's a very complex web that's unfolding in real time. And if it has any intelligence to it, which I think it does, I think there is a biological grid of intelligence of all 17 million species working together, then it would be working on these things and be looking at it from that point of view. You know, if I was going to design a global brain for biocybernetic organism for the entirety of nature, I would want to be able to speak the language of all the species and understand their points of view and to give them the information they need. So, as such, it becomes normal to start thinking about what would be a balanced system from different organisms' points of view, including microbes and bacteria. Mm-hmm. And that would be a natural ability of us as human beings to do that because we can see things from multiple points of view.
Absolutely.
It's a new type of metamaterial.
Metamaterials.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, this metamaterial is called a rectenna. And what it does is, like your car engine, it gets really hot, right? And it's generating a lot of heat and it's coming out of it. That's kind of wasted. It just goes into the air and it's not really being harvested for anything. Now, what we've found is that you can harvest it, but in order to do that, you have to capture the heat waves. And that's exactly what they are. They're heat waves. And so you tune into the frequency of the heat wave, say coming out of your automobile, and you convert it into electricity. And the conversion process uses a device known as a rectenna.
Hmm.
A rectenna.
Oh, so this would be a really good solution for the runaway heat problem that is part and parcel of the greenhouse gas.
Yes, it allows us to more quickly play and move heat around.
Right, so we want to
at the very
take that
convert
heat.
It to electricity, actually by reducing heat.
Right.
And using it for electricity,
reduce
which
heat,
is more useful anyway.
Turn it into electricity.
More refined.
Keep it out of the atmosphere. Keep it cool here on the Earth so that we don't melt the glaciers. Actually, speaking of melting the glaciers, I think that Bioneers project from, what was his name, Carter Brooks, there was a glacier melting homage with that giant block of ice.
Oh, yes, yes. There was an artist. He had a large block of ice, like 300-pound blocks of ice,
right,
hanging by chains, and you were watching it drip into this little garden.
Yeah. And his point was that we're past the point of being able to stop the glaciers from melting during our lifetime.
Mm.
So we are the generation that's going to witness that change and witness the vast climate change on the planet. Whether it's good that it's warmer or not, things will certainly not be as they were. We will not be getting the water in Lake Tahoe from the snowmelt. We will not be getting the water in the Ganges from the Himalayas glaciers.
Well, if there's anything to this, then we should design a system as a species that can play with change better, where the infrastructure is more fluid.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think the time is the Earth wants the space monkeys to get good at being very spontaneous in their survival skills and working with their immediate environment instead of working with fixed systems that are in place for 1,000 years. It's time for more sovereignty and self-awareness and personal integration with nature.
Like, for example, a creative thought idea. Like, how do we, say, take all that excess rain that's falling on Texas and move it over here? What would nature do? You know, if she could have total command of our technology, what would she do then? That's a thought exercise.
Okay. Good question. You have any ideas on it?
Of course, I think everyone would. Moving fluids from one location to another, I think, is something biology has done for a very long time.
Isn't that what the California Aqueduct is all about?
Well, we have done it for a very long time, too. Mm-hmm. But there's something about being better at it that we have to figure out yet. And once we do, we'll do it, right? How do we do it? I guess when we translate economically and in alignment with the ecosystem of our country.
So you're still in the mindset that it's a good idea to
move
terraform.
Water? No,
yeah,
no. I think moving. I think there's nothing wrong with moving stuff. I think it's a good idea to have as much intelligence as possible about the implications of moving stuff, of course, and be aware of it. But it is a living system, and living systems move stuff. That's what they do.
Right.
A lot of transport.
And so as a little guy, you want to help the big planet to move her water around? Is that what you're saying?
I think she would go for maximal health.
I see. And you think you have an idea of what her maximal health is?
Yeah.
And
ours too.
That's better than
win-win, I say.
The previous ideas that have already been laid on us by the planet herself.
What are you suggesting? We have too much of a species ego?
I detect hubris. I feel that Mother Earth has already mastered the art of putting water exactly where she likes it.
I see. So she's basically doing it just the way she likes it. And
if we want to help, we should really understand how she's doing it and why she's doing it and emulate that instead of trying to redirect it, right? We should try and enhance it.
Uh-huh. So we should all move to where the water is?
Well, I don't know.
That's
a big discussion. What should we do in the face of global climate change?
Well, I tell you.
What do individuals need to do for themselves to maintain their personal sovereignty?
Yeah.
And what do political organizations need to do for masses of individuals? And those are all hard to answer questions. All right. Well, listen, folks.
Are we already out of time already?
We're already out of time.
Oh, good. I have one more thing. I wanted to mention that there's this new 3D robotic technology that kind of looks like not an arm, but a different appendage.
Our guest is on the line.
Oh, she is. A robotic tentacle. I've got a great link. There's a video of this 3D printed soft robotic tentacle. It displays new levels of agility.
Great.
So check it out. After the break, we're going to bring on Catherine Miller, who is one of our favorite persons exploring the passionate edges of existence itself.
Absolutely. All right, folks, this is the Dr. Future Show on KSCO Santa Cruz, and we'll be back after CBS News and some traffic and weather. And then our guest, Catherine Miller. Stay tuned. Remember.